there is no description of the supramental transformation that Ashwapati underwent. But here I have a feeling that Savitri's yoga, not only do you have the psychic and the spiritual transformation of Savitri, but Savitri also undergoes supramental transformation. And this is, to my mind, in some sense, described or indicated in Canto 5 of Book 7, the finding of the soul. This is my hunch. I would like to be proved wrong on this, because it's good to make a hunch like this so other people can work on it and find evidence against it, because I can't just believe that Savitri was ready to take on the god of death without having acquired the supramental. Number one. Number two, our psychic being, when it meets the soul, it meets the Jivatman. But Savitri's psychic being, for her, the Jivatman is the Supreme Mother herself. So when Savitri's psychic being meets the Jivatman, the soul, it must be merging with the Supreme Divine Mother. And the Supreme, once you merge with the Supreme Divine Mother, you bring Supreme Divine Mother, stands for the supramental. And the description here also is not an ordinary description, an extraordinary description here. Just read it a little bit. Page 523. At last a change approached. The emptiness broke. A wave rippled within. The world had stirred. Once more her inner self became her space. There was felt a blissful nearness to the goal. Heaven leaned low to kiss the sacred hill. The air trembled with passion and delight, a rose of splendor on a tree of dreams. The face of dawn out of moon twilight grew. Day came, priest of a sacrifice of joy, into the worshipping silence of a world. He carried immortal luster as his robe, trailed heaven like a purple scarf, and wore as his vermilion caste mark a red sun. There are other descriptions here, which are extraordinary in their implications. And so this is where I personally feel that Savitri gets. Later on you have the Mahakundalini descending into Savitri. And as the Mahakundalini descends, I don't go into this because in 1 hour is too short a period of time to review all the high points of Savitri. But those of you, you have been with me for the last 11 years, probably you know this much better than I do. So I don't just have to indicate this Mahakundalini descends. And then the descent of the Mahakundalini is the descent of the supramental force in Savitri. That's what I would like to see. One more thing I would like to mention about Savitri's yoga, and that is there is a very interesting canto where Savitri is met by three Madonnas: Madonna of compassion and love, Madonna of might, and Madonna of wisdom. And each one of these Madonnas comes to Savitri and says that she is her soul. And what is interesting is, after each Madonna finishes whatever she has to say to Savitri, a perverted version of it, an egoistic perversion of each Madonna, complains to Savitri about how the world has ill-treated that particular being. Now it seems to me that these Madonnas, where they are like Durga and Kali and Lakshmi and so on, they must be overmental godheads. And Savitri has already met these overmental godheads, so if she goes beyond this, it's only into the supermental. The other interesting thing about this is, the overmental gods and goddesses have been with us for a very, very long time. And these gods and goddesses, we have been praying, we have been offering everything, our adoration, our worship, etc. And these gods and goddesses have proved by and large ineffectual in remedying the basic inadequacies of human consciousness. They have been able to give us money, success, fame, etc., etc. That's why we turn to these gods. But I don't think their coming down has been effective in cleansing the human heart of selfishness, of jealousy, of greed, of lust, and the kinds of things that have made our world such a miserable place. Because we, for that to happen, we need stronger gods, more powerful gods. And Sri Aurobindo says in one place, the war, the battle between the asuras and the devas has always been taking place in the quivering theater of the human consciousness. And there, the human consciousness itself has emerged from the inconscient, so it has a large stamp of the inconscient on it yet. And on it, you have descent of gods or divine powers and influences. You also descend on these very things, on this very consciousness, descent of the hostiles. So amidst all these, we are struggling. And in spite of our mental allegiance to God, it looks as if each time the asuras are winning. And the world is in such a big mess in spite of the gods we worship. Either there must be something with the gods we worship, or there must be something in the way, something wrong in the way we receive these gods within us. It doesn't matter which god we worship. What is important is which gods you incarnate in your own life. And so, it is now, a time has now come, not to discard the over-mental gods, but to keep them in their place. And once you are on this yoga, somebody asked the mother, "Mother, once we are on this new yoga, should we still be worshipping old gods?" And the mother gave a reply which is not very simple but very complicated. He said, once you are on this yoga and you start getting the real experiences on this yoga, you will never be satisfied by worshipping all the old gods individually, all of them put together. That's what she said. So a time has now come for us to focus on new gods, because we need a new consciousness to come down, and ultimately gods will not be able to destroy the asuras around us. We have to do it. The mother makes a very interesting comment in one place. She says, Durga Mahishasura Mardini comes down every year and kills the Mahishasura. But then she has to come again next year. She has to come every year. Why does she have to come every year? Because once she comes and destroys them, we get busy, after she has destroyed them, recreating Mahishasuras. It is something within us, and that's why the Buddha said, when a vibration of the evil comes to the human heart, human consciousness does not have the capacity to convert it into its opposite. We only strengthen it and send it back. And Buddha didn't know how to get out of this, and he suggested, sever all relationship with the world, then only you will be safe. But we don't want to do it. So, all this indicates that the time has come for us even to ward off all this, all the asuric hostile forces that are, you know, that manifest themselves as Hitler or Idi Amin or whatever. And they are all fed on the lifeblood of our own consciousness. We are all responsible for them in some sense or the other. Don't think I am very pure, I am very holy, I have done nothing about it. We all feed them. And if you want really to get rid of them, we need to be able to receive the new gods, we need to receive the supramental consciousness. This is what I see as the message of this particular canto, Triple Soul Forces. Now, Savitri has then, after Canto 5, a longer journey where she has been asked to go through an experience of emptying herself, and she says, you haven't got the supramental consciousness for yourself. If you want to be a channel, and through this channel, if you want to receive the supramental force, power and light, and spread it to the world, you have to learn to be an appropriate channel. You have to learn to empty yourself. And then they talk about a nirvana. There are two kinds of nirvana. One is the nirvana of the Advaitic and the Buddhist kind. In Sri Aurobindo's yoga, there is a nirvana where you, after reaching a particular siddhi, you offer this siddhi to the divine and empty yourself. Otherwise, as I say clearly, our path is all full of frozen yogis, you know, frozen buddhas all over, who don't want to move, who don't want to stir, because they are like laughing buddhas. They are all big with their own siddhis. They don't want to move. At every stage, once you have had your siddhi, you have to learn to offer it back to the divine. So there is space in you for a further siddhi. So the mother then goes through this process of emptying herself and then attains what is called the cosmic consciousness. and then she becomes an effective channel through which the higher force is now coming down on earth. At this stage, the description of Savitri's yoga is finished. Then of course you have the book 8 where you meet the god of death, and after that there are books 9, 10 and 11 of confrontation of the god of death and Savitri. Now god of death, somewhere there is a reference that these three books refer to the collective yoga of the mother. In other words, death is not just negation of physical existence. Death comes to us in many forms. Very often death comes to us in the glorified form of intellectual philosophies which capture you, which hold you spellbound, and which do not let you move into the higher region. They say, you know, you have come here, you are enough. You, the intellect has a way of fascinating the human mind. Oh, I have given an intellectual solution, and the intellectual solution comes, you feel thrilled. So there are various philosophies, pragmatism, realism, nihilism, and then that is also sometimes becomes a professor of Buddhist philosophy, Dvaita philosophy, all kinds of philosophies. None of it is completely false, but each one of it is incomplete. And Savitri completes this philosophy. You see, the integral philosophy of Sri Aurobindo, as you know, doesn't ignore any of the philosophies. What Sri Aurobindo simply is doing, take for example Marxism. He says Marxism is not all wrong. The only problem with Marxism, it is incomplete. Similarly, Freud's psychology is not wrong, but it's incomplete. Similarly, Darwin's biology and all the theories based on it, it's not wrong, but it is incomplete. That's the stance of Sri Aurobindo, that every one of these philosophies contains a kernel of truth, but there is a tendency to exaggerate these things. And Sri Aurobindo brings the completion for it. The same thing Savitri does again and again and again, until finally all the philosophies are exhausted. There are many, many wonderful passages. Now if I begin to read those passages, the organizers will feel jittery and will say, probably these people will stay on for dinner tonight, we haven't organized dinner. So I won't go that far. But one or two passages must be read. Otherwise, you know, it would be injustice to a book like this in a place like this. One of the favorite debating points for the god of death is to poo-poo love. Love is, he says, is a glandular, you know, glandular thing. It's something to do with the glands. There is no greatness in love and so on. Savitri doesn't deny it, but she says that's only true, partly true. But it has other more and more sublime and sublimated expressions. And the great assertion of love, he says on page 633, "For love must soar beyond the very heavens and find its secret sense ineffable. It must change its human ways to ways divine, yet keep its sovereignty of earthly bliss. O death, not for my heart's sweet poignancy, nor for my happy body's bliss alone, I have claimed from thee the living Satyavan, but for his work and mine, our sacred charge. Our lives are God's messengers beneath the stars. To dwell under death's shadow they have come, tempting God's light to earth for the ignorant race. His love to fill the hollow in men's hearts, his bliss to heal the unhappiness of the world. For I, the woman, am the force of God, he, the Eternal's delegate soul in man. My will is greater than thy law, O death. My love is stronger than the bonds of fate. Our love is the heavenly seal of the Supreme. I guard that seal against thy rending hands. Love must not cease to live upon the earth, for love is the bright link twixt earth and heaven. Love is the far transcendence angel here. Love is man's lion of the absolute." I don't think even Shakespeare has comparable lines on love. She's supposed to be a great poet of love. The another equally wonderful passage, very often people ask, how do you know that the supramental will come? It has not so far come. Very profound argument, isn't it? It's so far not come, how do you know it will come? Did you have a hotline from the supramental and say, I'm coming? What, how do you know? Death is asking that question. And Savitri's answer is very simple. How sayest thou, truth can never light the human mind, and bliss can never invade the mortal's heart, for God descend into the world he made. If in the meaningless void creation rose, if from a bodiless force matter was born, if life could climb in the unconscious tree, its green delight break into emerald leaves, and its laughter of beauty blossom in the flower, if sense could wake in tissue, nerve and cell, and thought seize the grey matter of the brain, and soul peep from its secrecy through the flesh, how shall the nameless light not leap on men, and unknown powers emerge from nature's sleep? It's a fairly long and beautiful passage. I feel hurt when I have to stop, but I think I have to stop because it's going on and on. Finally, death is vanquished. Something very significant happens. Savitri doesn't conquer her own death. Savitri conquers death for Satyavan. And who is Satyavan? We have been told in Savitri, Satyavan is the earth soul, the man soul in evolution. So in granting Satyavan freedom from death, what Savitri has granted to the whole of mankind is the potential for immortality. We have been rendered potentially immortal by this great gift of Savitri. Well, finally, there is a last stage in the drama. The god of death is vanquished, but he comes back as the supreme divine himself and once again tests Savitri and offers her a special world, a special heaven, and Savitri rejects that heaven and says, I have come down with Satyavan to help mankind reach perfection. I don't want any solitary happiness. And finally, when Savitri passes this test as well, the god then comes out with benediction and says, Savitri, you have done, you have fulfilled all my expectations of you. And then he predicts that one day everything will change and a new world will come and this life will turn into life divine. Ladies and gentlemen, it is extremely difficult to summarize this whole thing in 50 minutes, but I must be one of the fools who ever tried and achieved it in some fashion. Thank you very much.
I think we all wouldn't have minded at all if Dr. Madhukarni had continued for another half an hour. But anyway, the time has come. First, just to make a few announcements, and then I would like to thank him on behalf of all of you. As you know, this place, Savitridhavan, we're so happy to have Nirodha with us again here today. In 96, he has laid the foundation stone here, invoked the blessings of Mother and Sri Aurobindo and the presence of Savitri. And that is what has brought us all here today, as on so many other occasions. Savitridhavan is dedicated to receiving and, if possible, manifesting and embodying the spirit of Savitri. And we are so grateful to Dr. Madhukarni for all his contributions in that direction and for all his support. And all of you who have been giving support to Savitridhavan, I think you will be very happy to know that we have received now the renewal of the 100% tax exemption for the Aurobindo Foundation, which means that any donations that you are able to give, about 500 rupees, you will be able to ask for that 100% tax exemption from the Government of India. For those of you who have not yet received your copies of our special 125th birth anniversary of the Mother issue of Invocation, you can take them from our shelter here. If you are already on our mailing list, your envelope will be there. Otherwise, you can just take a copy and leave your name if you'd like to receive it in the future. I've been asked to make one other announcement, which is that one of the centers in Andhra Pradesh has brought out this beautiful recording of the 1,000 names of the mother. This is available in the beach office. All the gentlemen can please stand up. The gentleman has a few copies with him if you would like to have from him. So I think these are all the announcements I have to make. On behalf of all of you, I want not only to say heartfelt thanks to Dr. Nadkarni for today's talk, for the whole study camp, for the whole series of study camps, and all the insights and inspiration that he has given to all of us in the course of that series of study. I think in addition, you would all like to join me in wishing him bon fête for tomorrow. And the little gift that I'm presenting on behalf of all of us, it is as a memento of this occasion. It's a birthday gift, and it's also a little gift jointly with Mrs. Nadkarni, with best wishes for stepping into their new residence in Pondicherry. So we are very happy that they're going to be able to spend more time here in our neighborhood. Thank you very, very much. Now I invite you all to take some refreshments with us.
Only of that which is by itself a lifetime's effort. It is not something, you know, people who are talking about the supramental and the higher, etc., very often, you know, when they give talks and write as if they try to imply that this is all very easy. Oh, Nirvana, oh, that's very easy. It's not easy. We are not even in the kindergarten. It may not be the highest, but it's a great siddhi, and unless you are there, you can't even mouth these words. One has to be there first. First, get this timeless immortality. Be aware of that presence in you, which is never born, which never dies, which is Satchidananda by itself. Now, the problem with that, and that's where Sri Aurobindo comes, if you focus your attention just on that, then you automatically feel a revulsion, a kind of revolt against this world. Because this world is a limiting consciousness. Everything here is limits. So what Sri Aurobindo says is, not only should you be aware of that within you, which is beyond birth and which is beyond death, but there is something, a representative of that, a soul in evolution here. There is divinity not only in the being, but also in the becoming. Now who has become this person that is sitting here and talking to you? Who is the person listening to me? That is the Lord himself. And there is the presence of the Lord here in the becoming. And unless you are aware of the presence of the Lord in minute to minute in this becoming, the great danger, the great trap is that you will discard this world, you will reject this world and go into nirvana or moksha or whatever. Once you do that, then the entire enterprise is what they call it short-circuited. You understand short-circuited? As a result, the perfection in the outer world, God is always perfect himself. What he created this world is to feel this perfection in manifestation. That's the program. And all this whole creation, 15 billion years it is in the making, and it has gone so wide, so beautifully, so wildly, and God doesn't seem to be in a great hurry. See, all spiritual speakers, you know, lecturers, etc., doing satsang, they give the impression that God is in a great hurry for you to finish his drama. He is not in a great hurry, but what he wants to see, make sure that the world is going on the path of dharma. That is a Godward journey. That journey has to be kept going. Now one has therefore to take an interest in this life, live in this life, bring that consciousness of immortality, and then open your physical consciousness, the body consciousness, so that gets changed, that gets transformed. And that cannot get transformed easily. And the tapasya that the mother did for about 25 years after Sri Aurobindo's passing, I don't think the world has ever seen a tapasya of this kind. It is tapasya which will, future historians, when they remember it, that one human being could attract to herself all this suffering and never complained about it. Because this is, in the course of nature, something that would have taken 5,000, 10,000 years. And because she took it on herself and did this tapasya, now there is a possibility that the result of her tapasya, and she was not doing tapasya for herself. Sri Aurobindo always used to say, I am not in this business because I want the supramental for myself. I am in this business to make it accessible to mankind, to human beings. And my aim is, I am willing to pay any price to make sure that man can access it, man can receive it. And later on when we take up this question, you will see, Sri Aurobindo was willing to give an instrument which has already been almost supramentalized, his own body, to this task. And then the mother did this tapasya, and this is the tapasya that still has to be done. The major part of the tapasya, the major hurdles have been broken. The path has been made much smoother. There are fewer hurdles there, fewer obstacles there. When Sri Aurobindo was saying, you know, I have suffered 1,001 wounds, and I am digging in this furrow of filth and mire. He was all doing this tapasya for us. When the mother was dying almost every day and being reborn the next day, that was the tapasya she was doing, it in it, the excruciating pain that physically she bore. This is all a part of this tapasya, and this is the yoga of the gradually which will ultimately bring us this freedom from the hold and sway of death. That yoga has still to be done, and I don't think I am at all in any way competent to talk about it in any detail. The whole thing has been discussed, talked about in Agenda, the 13 volumes of Agenda. If you know how to read it carefully, there is a lot of material there which would be of great help. So the point I am once again emphasizing is, one could go into these details, but then our main purpose is Savitri, that remains aside. I just wanted to give you this background. Sri Aurobindo's yoga, Sri Aurobindo's attempt, or what he has been saying, that we must conquer death. This is not at all any, you know, any kind of fantasy. This is a part of his yogic program. It's a part of his yogic agenda. And the work has been more or less done. The supramental consciousness has already come down. But as I said, the body is still the body suited for the mental consciousness. The new body has yet to come. And of course, you can always find people like me who can give eloquent lectures on these subjects, but who are not yet prepared to give their consciousness for this change. So it's going, you know, God goes, as it were, knocking from door to door, are you ready? He said, no, I'm not yet ready, I'm still on chapter 28 of Life Divine, I have to see another 28 come next time. We're all saying that for some reason or the other, but this is what is needed. And this work is a quiet work, and nobody is going to announce your name in the newspapers. You will not be, your name will not go up for a President's Award or what, Rashtrapati Award or anything, but this is the work to be done. And this is very, very serious work. And And enough people have to believe in this. The mother says someplace that this consciousness of death and that death is inevitable and death comes to you is ingrained so deeply in your consciousness. And you know, many of my friends who know that I underwent a bypass operation are surprised that I still keep moving around. You're all right? Are you really all right? It's not that, we are all like that. We all expect death to crawl and, you know, take pounce on us at any time. And the mother always said, drive this fear out. You know, very often people have complained, oh, the mother and Sri Aurobindo created the impression they were going to be here forever and ever and will take us with them. They had to do it. Because suppose they started saying, look, one day when we go, you continue on this path of immortality, who would do it? So they had the first task of make us believe that this program, which is against the program of all religions so far, this is not a fantasy, this is a reality. And the first thing they had to do was drive this fear out. Never fear death and never welcome it. If it comes in the course of things, well, you know, you are on this path, you will come back again this path and you will continue your yoga, you will continue your struggle. And therefore, in one sense, as you will see here at the end of Savitri, this canto 4 that you will see, theoretically, in principle, the reign of death has come to an end. The death continues, as I will show you when I read it, because the mother has said, you are my instrument, you have some more work to do, so continue there until your work is finished. So that is the background. I think we all need to understand this relationship between Sri Aurobindo and the mother and what they said about death. Now I won't go back to this. I will come back to the general issues of Sri Aurobindo's passing and the mother's passing, because we should know a little about it, but not now, when we come later, when we actually come to our study of Canto 4. I think are central to the thesis I am trying to develop. This is on my page 666. We haven't yet come to it in the course of our study of Canto 4. We'll come to that, where it says at the end, I hail thee, almighty and victorious death. Just imagine, at the moment of death's defeat, this is the point, as you will see when we study Canto 4, death has completely been vanquished. At this moment, Savitri is hailing him as victorious death. Why is death victorious? Because death has fulfilled its mission. What is this mission? Goading mankind, giving no rest to mankind until the mankind finds the final solution. Because, as I said, death is an instrument of evolution. It will not let you lie down in peace. It will prod you, it will prick you. It will keep making you look for an answer. And finally the answer has been found. And at this moment, which is a moment of defeat, Savitri is hailing him as victorious death. He is victorious because he, as an instrument of evolution, has succeeded man in prodding to find a final answer to the problem of death. So he says, I hail thee, almighty and victorious death, thou grandiose darkness of the infinite, O void that makes room for all to be, hunger that gnaweth at the universe, consuming the cold remnants of the suns and eats the whole world with thy jaws of fire. This is Kala. As in the Gita described, you know, he just chewing all the various worlds. This is what death is. Waster of the energy that has made the stars. Inconscience carrier of the seeds of thought. Nascence in which all knowledge sleeps entombed and slowly emerges in its hollow breast, wearing the mind's mask of bright ignorance. Thou art my shadow and my instrument. He says, thou art my shadow and my instrument. As my instrument, you have succeeded. And what is the great success? The great success is the instrument may not be needed. The instrument will not be needed for a long time now, because man has already been prompted to seek the solution. So he says, thou art my shadow and my instrument. I have given thee thy awful shape of bread. I have given you this awful shape of bread, she says, and thy sharp sword of terror and grief and pain. Why? To force the soul of man to struggle for light. To force the soul of man to struggle for light on the brevity of his half-conscious days. Thou art his spur to greatness in his works, the whip to his yearning for eternal bliss, his poignant need of immortality. Live death. When everything is finished and death is defeated, what does she say? Live. Live death a while. Be still my instrument. This is the main thesis I have been trying to develop the last 3 days in this first session, and I think this should be enough. We'll yesterday. Yesterday we concluded our review of Canto 2 of Book 9. We're now moving on to Book 10, Canto 1. We have Cantos 1, 2 and 3 to review before we take up Canto 4. So review has to be a review. And so we can't go in all the detail, into all the details, but I think I said enough about Canto 2 to give you a flavor of the structure of the argument. And one of the things you must have noticed is that in all these debates, the viewpoint put forward by the God of Death always contains a valid truth. Death, God of Death, doesn't indulge in falsehoods and lies. So whatever he says, there is always a truth in it. And Savitri therefore doesn't waste her time in confronting that truth. What she does is she juxtaposes the larger truth, the complete, the integral truth, which incorporates the truth presented by the God of Death. But in comparison with the integral truth, you find that the truth presented by the God of Death is incomplete. So this is not what you find in a court between two lawyers, that he makes a point, you counter that point, and he makes another point, you counter that point. It's not that. Both are presenting truth, but the truth presented by the God of Death invariably is a partial truth, is an incomplete truth. And very often Savitri says that here, again and again he says, you are offering only a partial truth, but this is the complete truth, this is the integral truth as I see it. And so, this is something we must bear in mind, that the viewpoint presented by the God of Death on any one of these issues always contains truth in it. It's not falsehood, but it is a limited truth. It is not the integral truth. Now, whether it is his God of Death dismissing idealism, making a case for realism, or later on he champions the cause of materialism, these are the two things that happen in this book. In both cases, what he says is quite sound, but not complete. And it is Savitri who completes it, gives the whole truth, and in comparison with the whole truth, what the God of Death presents looks limited. This is the nature of the dialogue.